This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm going to try and say something general about the so-called crisis of the humanities. But really, perhaps, when I introduce specific examples, the vast majority of them relate to the British universities and the current situation in the UK. So I hope that those particular examples do have some kind of general purchase in the context of the broader argument. What I'm going to say tonight, perhaps contrary to my title, isn't quite as apocalyptic as the no future Jean-Michel referred to in the introduction. I'm also slightly nervous about doing this under the avuncular gaze of John Cage. I looked at the exhibit earlier on Cage, and I noticed that he allegedly never spoke for more than 3 minutes on any single topic. And I think I'm going to fail miserably to meet that ineffable standard. Some of you may know Andrew Del Banco's recent book on the fate of the humanities and the American university. Del Banco's book is one of the latest in a now fairly long line of what we'd call broadly liberal defenses of the university, which attempt to mount a case based on the traditions of the institution itself and a default commitment to what we would now rather nervously perhaps call liberal democracy. Like many such recent contributions, Martha Nussbaum's Not For Profit, Stefan Collini's What Are Universities For?, the limits of Del Banco's argument are determined by what I want to call the porous limits of the modern university itself. Del Banco isn't willing to pursue the logic of his argument beyond the point where what is intrinsic to the university collides with extrinsic factors, economic, political, ideological. Like many others who have contributed to this debate, Del Banco can't quite bring himself to conclude that the 21st century university, instrumentalized, corporatized, and perhaps even degraded as it is, actually reflects very well the dominant ideology it serves. It's therefore quite incongruous, but also, I think, deeply instructive, that Del Banco chooses to conclude his book with a chapter entitled, in time-honored fashion, What is to be Done? Del Banco, of course, doesn't really propose to answer the question with any seriousness. Neither, I'm happy to say, does he advocate the formation of a vanguard party that will organize the academic masses towards the moment of armed insurrection. But he's nonetheless unable to resist associating his subject, however superficially, with the urgency, the crisis-driven justification of revolutionary politics. This incongruity is taken to new and unexpected heights with the launch of a new campaigning organisation in the UK, literally 2 weeks ago. It goes under the title The Council for the Defence of British Universities. Anxious to emphasise that the consensus among the organisation's founding members was such that there was no need, really, to waste time lamenting the parlous state of the British universities, the CDBU's first utterance in its own inauguration was, yes, you've guessed it, what is to be done? So in anticipation of the question as to why I might choose to talk about Lenin in relation to the fate of the humanities and the corporate university, my provisional response is therefore simply that the debate has quite astonishingly provoked me into doing so. Now, in invoking a foundational if problematic, text of the left, but without pursuing its implications. Both Del Banco and the CDBU signal very clearly the lack of appetite to move the ground of the debate on the humanities and the university across this intrinsic-extrinsic divide, if indeed it's in any sense valid to describe the divide as such. They also reveal, I think, something quite important about what has become of the once-upon-a-time shibboleths of a Leninist politics, and by extension, any politics that seeks to repudiate or reinterpret the boundaries between the intrinsic and the extrinsic. Now, it's far from original to point out that what is to be done or all power to the Soviets have been entirely emptied of their meaning by the repetition out of the context that produced them. It's perhaps more instructive to remind ourselves that slogans such as socialism in one country have also lost their meaning, but in an entirely different way. The point, I think, is to examine what this implies about the politics such slogans no longer stand for. And that will, I hope, allow me to say a number of things that relate equally to the real nature of what I hesitate to call a Leninist politics, but also to use this as a particular frame within which to consider the future of the humanities and indeed of the university itself. Many myths about Lenin have persisted through the traduction of his politics that's at stake in the simultaneous voiding and retention of some of the slogans that I've referred to. But two myths are perhaps more persistent than the rest. First, as even Frederick Jameson has been tempted to repeat recently, and I quote, "What everyone agrees to have been Lenin's most original idea is the party and the party structure." This idea has certainly taken solid root, partly because of a determination to identify what in Lenin explicitly differs from Marx, as if this was such a difficult task, but partly also through willful misreadings of what is to be done itself. Academic historians in the Western tradition post-war almost exclusively belong to this camp of willful misreaders and have been energetic in the denial that Lenin's particular approach to organization might have anything remotely to do with the material conditions of Russia in the early 20th century. And those historians have, in what I think is a quite brilliant irony, thereby universalized this notion of Lenin's theory of organization. In the same essay that Jameson is rather surprising, I think, in his repetition of this myth about Lenin, he also contradicts himself by arguing towards the conclusion, and again I quote, "If one wants to imitate Lenin, one must do something different." And this surely applies to the second persistent myth about Lenin, namely that his politics is reducible in the final analysis to a commitment to armed insurrection. That Lenin is a theorist and practitioner of revolution as a singular event. Again, this is the not entirely unique distinction of being entirely contrary to the historical account and dispensing breezily with the theoretical and even philosophical core of Lenin's revolutionary practice. On this, Jameson is absolutely accurate in his characterization, acknowledging the extreme difficulties in attempting to deal with notions such as party or capitalism as philosophical concepts. Jameson captures the essence of Lenin's revolutionary practice in his description of a radically open fusion of, quotes, event as process and process as event, which demands at every step a collective awareness of the ways in which revolution is being played out in each of its existential episodes. To put it in terms slightly less elegant than Jameson, Lenin's perpetual injunction would not be expressed in our present conjuncture in the form it assumed in either April or September, October 1917, when we should remember his abrupt tactical shifts culminating in the call for armed insurrection provoked, even in those closest to him, the fear that he had lost his mind. As has been said on many occasions and in many and various ways, Lenin's theory of revolution is reducible, I think, in the final analysis, to no more than a perpetual injunction to enter the realm of dialectical questioning, and must therefore be determined by events in themselves, understood not tactically or opportunistically, but, to retrieve a phrase from Slavoj Žižek's sometimes perplexing take on Lenin, in terms of, I quote, the conjunctures that are themselves posited as specific modes of contradiction of the main contradiction. There are two further implications of the precise terms in which Jameson chooses to express this point that I want to briefly refer to before moving on to talk about the humanities in revolt. First, Jameson is at pains to evoke, and again I quote, the whole lengthy, complex process of systematic transformation in which so many individual events and crises are themselves components of an immense historical dialectic, invisible and absent as an empirical perception at every one of these points, but whose overall movement alone gives them meaning. Now, on one level, this represents a once again fairly typical reminder of the determinant context that allows us to differentiate tactics from strategy, reform from revolution. But I want to appropriate and extend this frame as a specific way of understanding the relationship between revolution, on one hand, the scope of which potentially extends beyond all horizons, and independent but not isolated acts or practices of revolt. The relationship between the two has spatial, temporal dimensions, but it might also be understood precisely in order to allow us to suspend for a time the question of horizons, metonymically. And I'll say a little bit more about the dialectical dimension of this metonymy presently. Second, and even more curiously and interestingly, it's worth drawing attention to Jameson's slightly curious use of tense in the quotation I gave a moment ago in relation to the fusion of event as process and process as event. To repeat, this process demands at every step a collective awareness of the ways in which revolution is being played out in each of its existential episodes. Is being played out. Is it? Is Jameson here intentionally resorting to a subtle stylistic emphasis, or has he too perhaps lost his mind? I want to suggest that the answer is neither. The lesson, so to speak, is that the coordinates of crisis, the word that is now universally applied to the condition of the humanities, truly reveal themselves only in the present tense. Or in other words, we are never entirely masters of our own conjuncture. Now, that being the case, we must be careful not to fall into the trap of assuming that because what is to be done takes the form of a question, we can proceed simply and straightforwardly by offering a series of substantive propositions in response to it. I want to characterize it as a meta question, which in the words of Savas Michael Matsis, is an injunction to find how to put the right questions. And this I propose to do with regard to the humanities and their place in the contemporary university, as I said, under the sign of metonymy. Or, if you're willing to accept what I concede amounts to a dialecticization of Roman Jakobson, to examine the university, however crudely, as one of the conjunctures that are themselves posited as specific modes of concentration of the main contradiction. Now, in order to organize these remarks, in order to not make a deficiency of intelligibility out of their intended dialectical virtue, I want to structure them around a number of fundamental questions. These questions will, however, inevitably bleed into one another, as well as generating a number of secondary questions in their turn. The three questions are simply this. Who are the agents of the humanities in revolt? What is the proper object of the humanities in revolt? And finally, to what extent do our conclusions about agent and object circumscribe the location of revolt? I have to make a confession at this point. The image may or may not relate directly to the frame of analysis that I'm proposing. But when I came across it, I simply couldn't resist it. So under the rather practical justification of giving you something to look at if your attention wavers, this comes from a magazine called The Plebs, slightly in advance of the First World War in England. And what it's thematizing is the possibility that higher education can function outside the conventional university structure. This is the era of the working men's college, the rise of adult education in England. And as I say, I can't resist the chair of applied lies and the chair of piffle. Whether we buy into the juxtaposition of capitalist and working class. Who are the agents of the humanities in revolt? We'll begin with the assumption that the primary agents of revolt must be academics working in the humanities, arranged in a matrix of employment relationships with various universities and colleges. This immediately poses a number of difficulties. First, clearly, the nature of employment in particular cases will affect the respective freedom of action of individuals, with only a very small percentage of senior faculty enjoying anything like immunity, and that only in certain particular locations. Beyond that, a generation of tenured but unpromoted faculty may have to accept a particular instantiation of the tension between systemic and piecemeal gains, their own personal progression being recast as a microcosmic constituent of the latter. Worse even than that, in a process that's substantially already underway, adjunct and sessional faculty may find that the price of revolt is a form of partial or even total exclusion from the main site of practice in the humanities, the institution of the university. That raises a separate question to which I'll return under the headings of the object and the location of revolt. For the moment, I think we're bound to consider another aspect of the problem of agency, one that goes beyond the specifics of how precisely humanities academics are organized in this matrix of employment. And this, crudely put, is the other face of the question of, it's in my text with inverted commas, I hope I can do it intonationally, solidarity. The fact that we might very easily anticipate the critical response to Dalbanco and Nussbaum from the left should not obscure the fact that their position has attracted a quite different critique from those who, on the other hand, persist in the view that liberal humanism is the left. A vivid example of this is the main criticism of Dalbanco's book offered by the apostate academic Joseph Epstein, for whom, and I quote, defending the liberal arts and the condition in which they linger on scarcely seems worth the struggle. The root of the problem for Epstein is that although Dalbanco, in his estimation, is a sufficiently Protestant secular Jew, and hence unfailing in his identification of the sins of the modern liberal arts as opposed to the sins committed against them, Dalbanco, Epstein claims, nonetheless lets off the hook a mysterious class of academics Epstein refers to as, I quote, the guys in the next room. These guys, bear with me, this may get amusing in a cheap kind of way, turn out to be the proponents of, quotes, deconstruction, academic feminism, historicism, Marxism, early queer theory, and other, in Wallace Stevens' phrase, one-idea lunacies. This tendentious clownishness, again in quotes, Epstein doesn't doubt, is the real cause of the demise of the liberal arts. Now, I raise this by now tedious and untenable polarization of the humanities, not with the equally tedious purpose of adjudicating or resolving, but rather to illustrate the difficulty of persuading various fractions of the academic humanities to act in concert with what I'm going to unapologetically term their own class interests, even if it were possible to elide the differentials in pay and conditions that we referred to earlier on. But I've always been engaged or committed and non-engaged camps in the academic humanities, however imperfectly those divisions may be drawn. I'll have more to say about the common class interests of those two broad groupings in my conclusion. For the moment, their apparent irreconcilability prompts a reflection on what by now must appear the quite utopian notion of solidarity. And that is that no revolt or revolution has ever been predicated in its actual practice on such solidarity. This also points up the significance of another slightly more marginal myth about Lenin, namely his apparent taste for the sectarian. The lesson I want to suggest is that demarcation, as opposed to sectarianism, is not only acceptable, but also necessary and desirable in its clear exposure of elements of the particular conjuncture. And I want to suggest somewhat hopefully that when the crisis reaches its fullest development, the heirs of Epstein who remain in the academy, as well as those such as Dalbanco, will find a mode of accommodation with the guys in the next room. Before moving on to object, I want to say a very brief word about another often ignored constituency under the heading of agency, namely students and potential students of the humanities. It might be argued that the oft-quoted statistics for declining numbers of liberal arts majors in American universities actually represent the de facto revolt of the latter. who, for reasons that are related in quite complex ways to corporatization and instrumentalization, are increasingly rejecting all variants of the humanities. More interesting, perhaps, has been the response of those students already in the system. And I want to represent this with this image of the participants of the group known as Book Block, with once again center stage among their ironized riot shields that have been directed back to riot police, the Italian translation of Lenin's What Is to Be Done. I want to focus on one example, again from the United Kingdom. In the autumn and winter of 2010, students mobilized in their tens of thousands in protest against the Brown Report on higher education, in ways that hadn't been witnessed in the UK since the heyday of the campaign for nuclear disarmament. The Brown Report had proposed the trebling of the fee that English universities could charge undergraduates, while simultaneously the government's comprehensive spending review removed 80% of public funding for teaching, including the removal of 100% of public support for teaching in the humanities and social sciences. Liability was thus transferred directly onto students in the form of loans, and the English universities were substantially privatized overnight, with no reference to the democratic process. The human and social sciences were, from the point of view of government, the legitimate sacrifices that would facilitate this process. The response of students was, and I think remains, deeply instructive. This wasn't, remember, a mass movement on an issue of global importance such as nuclear disarmament, but on the surface, a matter of educational policy that would, crucially, not directly affect those who were protesting. More than a local or circumscribed protest against educational policy, however, the events of late 2010, I think, represented the first meaningful encounter of that generation with Britain's calamitous and developing democratic deficit, and the effects of that on conjunctures to come may prove crucial. What is the proper object of revolt? The central assumption of recent commentary and activity has been that the object of revolt must be the governmental or state institutions that affect educational policy. So in the UK, the coalition government, and perhaps the party that hopes to replace it at the next election. This seems to me broadly misguided, if only because neither main party had sought a mandate on the basis of any policy whatsoever with regard to higher education. Both had agreed to implement the recommendations of the Brown Report before it had even been commissioned. And the third party, which is now part of the coalition government, had made the only clear manifesto promise in relation to higher education. Predictably, a loudly trumpeted commitment not to increase fees, which was abandoned within months of the election. The lesson here, which I must be very careful not to present as any kind of easy parallel with the period between 1905 and 1917 in Russia, is that parliamentary democracy, while it can't be ignored, becomes a bulwark against democracy if it's pursued as the sole means of political agency. Academics and students must focus, I think, in the first instance, on their own immediate environment, on the institutions with which they are directly associated. That focus may involve various forms of organization, unionization. It may involve academics linking their own research work more explicitly to the context in which universities function. But it must also involve, I think, at the level of the individual, a focus on the practices and assumptions through which the institution is governed. It's here, so to speak, that circumstances are at their most concrete, and hence that concrete analysis can and must emerge. So I want to make two concrete suggestions as to what the humanities must, in the most immediate sense, revolt against. In an environment where interdisciplinarity has been raised almost to the status of a universal virtue, it's difficult even to name the first of these. The humanities must first of all revolt against science and scientism. And there are two intimately related reasons why I think that is the case. First, on a practical level, it's become clear that what I'm going to take great pleasure in calling the logic of science, there's a gag there for those of you who are so inclined. The logic of science has come to dominate entirely what I've just described as the processes and assumptions by which universities are governed, in the UK at least. In every phase of the work of the university, the imperatives of science establish operational norms to which the humanities and social sciences are required to adapt, and the extent to which individual disciplines are able to do so will largely determine those disciplines' fate in the coming years. In the UK, the operative understanding of what research consists in is derived entirely from scientific research and makes little or no concession to the fundamental conceptual distinction of inquiry in the humanities. The imperatives of the Research Excellence Framework, or REF, a uniquely British mechanism for measuring the quality of research and dispersing funds on the basis of those measurements, are entirely the imperatives of science, and crudely understood at that. In graduate supervision, the laboratory model is assumed as an implicit norm. In undergraduate teaching, instructional methods that are appropriate for chemistry or mathematics, including the growing reliance on online delivery, are implicitly or explicitly held to be appropriate for all. The corrosive effects of this are intensified, however, by the fact that each individual component of the problem is contained in the same enormous, breathtaking denial, which exposes the falsity of all received assumptions about the viability of certain subjects, the humanities chief among them. The most concrete of concrete circumstances in higher education, I want to suggest, which is simultaneously declared and repressed at every turn, is that research and teaching in science are enormously, in some cases, ruinously expensive. The British universities have subjugated their entire economies to the maintenance of scientific research, with other subjects contributing to either the maintenance of the broad academic prestige that justifies university status, or in some cases, de facto subsidy of the scientific disciplines. Now, many would argue that this is all well and good, and I might even be inclined to agree up to a point, were it not for two key factors. First, as I've said, the situation is sustained under a cloak of denial, which demands that the unspoken can't simply be left just as that, but must instead be negated by the rabid maintenance of its opposite. Everything else must serve the falsehood that sits at the heart of the modern university. The second factor concerns how this denial is perpetuated or reflected or more properly programmed at the level of government. Again, this may be a familiar story. Science, technology, engineering and mathematics have been explicitly identified in the UK context as strategically important, as the areas of both research and teaching that are crucial to the competitiveness of the economy and future growth. And again, that all may be fine as far as it goes. The problem is that it conceals a different kind of denial. In fact, neither central government nor private industry, the very agents who assert the primacy of these subjects and their centrality in economic terms, are willing to fund universities in ways that reflect the propositional logic of their own case. For large-scale industrial corporations, universities are a relatively cheap way of limiting their own in-house commitments to research and development. But of course, that only remains the case for as long as government is willing to maintain the infrastructural base. Government, squeezed by the pincer movement of corporate retrenchment and the financial crisis, blindly or otherwise introduces policy that forces universities to attempt to square the unsquareable circle by giving themselves over to an unholy amalgam of the logic of science and the logic of capital. Let's go back to that image. The fiendish logic of the current situation is that when government says there is no money for humanities and social sciences, it does so not only to provoke those subject areas into a grotesque, self-generated marketization based on the tragic illusion that they too can prove, albeit at one remove, their own economic utility. It does so more fundamentally in order to conceal the underlying truth that there is no money for science and technology either. I haven't even begun to chart the secondary effects of this deception built on denial on the intellectual and conceptual development of the humanities, as opposed to what I've rather inadequately termed the practical dimension. This, as some of us know, involves the fevered coupling of research agendas in the humanities to the agendas of science in pursuit of either economic or intellectual validation or both. It may once upon a time have been a valid and productive undertaking to write a book on, say, literature and technology or medical practice as a source of literary and political metaphor, and I hope that at some point in the future it will be again. What I want to suggest that is in the present conjuncture, such undertakings, whatever their interdisciplinary motivations, have been contextualized as moments in the retreat and eventual subsumption of the humanities. It's tempting to label this process forcible colonization, but it's in fact more accurately self-colonization, exemplary of how individual agents are conditioned to behave in a particular way when exposed to the ineluctable force of an enveloping logic. Now, my response may look like a curious and even dangerous form of sectarianism, but I'd characterize it instead as a critical act of demarcation, necessitated by the coordinates of the concrete situation. if the humanities are not able to revolt against the logic of science, as it conditions both the practices and assumptions by which universities are governed, and by extension, the humanities' own very subject matter, there will at some stage be no humanities other than the medical humanities, or the digital humanities, or the neurohumanities, with the exception, perhaps, of a few privileged outposts predicated on the concentrated irony of culture as capital, a superficial embellishment or index of prestige. Now, I have in fact already moved to description of the second object of the revolt of the humanities in consideration of the first science. This is because, in the United Kingdom at least, it is no longer possible to think of the university outside of or beyond the logic of science. The humanities must therefore revolt against its own primary location, which it founded and which has in turn sustained it over hundreds of years, the university itself. And this, of course, leads on directly to my final heading, the location of revolt. To put that slightly more detail, to what extent do agency and object circumscribe the location of revolt? Perhaps the best way to frame the question of location is to ask the following simple, if deathly, question. What if such a revolt of the humanities against its primary location, the university, were to fail? Can the humanities live beyond the death of the university founded on the humanities? Many people would respond that the humanities has always done so, and indeed that one of the persistent problems of the academic humanities has been its reluctance and inability to deal on equal terms with the institutions that sustain the practice that many humanities disciplines take as their object. From galleries, public art foundations, theatre groups, independent film production, literary and cultural publishing industry, and we could go on. A particularly embittered form of that response would argue that the humanities might do just fine, perhaps becoming a more integrated element of the life processes of those who are interested. Research in the humanities wouldn't suddenly cease, but increasingly, as in fact, again, it has always done, seek and find its outlet beyond the narrow frame of academic publishing. In parenthesis, itself perhaps approaching terminus in the form that we've known it. This embittered interpretation would conclude that it's not in fact the humanities, but rather humanities academics who would suffer from the loss of the university. To shorthand the argument, the tenured professional status, already, we should remind ourselves, a minority employment model, would give way to a model that has always existed around, for example, art and art education, where teaching is largely performed as a hired service by practitioners or specialists who practice elsewhere. I think there's a fundamental problem, however, with this all too likely scenario. The art school is a relatively homogeneous entity, the core orientation of which, if we leave aside these practical and ethical problems of employment, is not undermined per se by a dispersed model of teaching delivery. In the university context, however, with its huge diversity of subject areas, a development of this nature in one particular area would gradually stand in stark contrast to the more or less maintained status quo in other areas. Humanities academics of the future might resemble the large class of language instructors that has grown up in the UK over recent years, 85% of whom are employed on inferior terms to the permanent, in inverted commas, academic staff they teach alongside. That's a single speculative example, but it serves here to point up the larger issue that's at stake in imagining the loss of the university. The paradox I want to suggest is that both the bureaucrats, driven by the logic of science, and indeed academics in the humanities, could, with a little adaptation, probably bear the loss with specific regard to research. But could we, in inverted commas, I won't ask about them, in inverted commas, bear the loss in terms of education? What's at stake in the projected loss of the university is not the originary model of a community of scholars where teaching, such as it formerly existed, was indistinguishable from a normatively hierarchical process of scholarship. It is rather the model of the university as an institution of the direct, large-scale dissemination we call teaching or education. An institution that no longer provides such education in the humanities on an implicitly equal footing with other disciplines would no longer be a university in any meaningful definition of the term. And here, the paradoxical potential consensus between us and them disintegrates. They, the bureaucrats driven by the logic of science, may find ways to bear the loss. Happy, in fact, to have wrested the powerful and therefore valuable signifier, university, from those who cast themselves, like the CDBU, as its defenders. We, academics in the humanities, would have lost the institution of the university as a force for education, and there would be little or no consolation in the reflection that the university therefore, in fact, no longer existed. I want to move to a conclusion which you won't be surprised to learn I've titled, What Then Is to Be Done? There are many valid responses at the level of outward-facing instrumental action, as we've seen, different forms of collective organization, such as unionization or wider public campaigns, all the way to what I'm going to describe as the internalization of the imperatives of resistance into everyday practice. Confronting different forms of bureaucratic demand in a way that is analogous to how the citizen would expect to negotiate his or her rights and responsibilities in the broader polis. That might apply equally to academics in and beyond the humanities, which is absolutely no reason to question its validity. But a second point, by extension, and of far greater significance, I think, is that that general prescription for response ignores an important and perhaps definitive aspect of the conjuncture specific to the humanities, what we might call the humanities' determinant contradiction. This is, as has hopefully been prepared above, that the humanities, in an important sense, is the university, and that the university does not and cannot exist while at the same time expelling the humanities to its institutional periphery, or by retaining the humanities as a circumscribed component of an institution's particular offer, as opposed to a motivating principle on which the institution is founded. What humanities academics must therefore do, above all, and in parallel to any kind of instrumentally orientated responses, is pursue scholarship and teaching in their particular specialization, from medieval Arabic poetry to the history of domestic labor in the 19th century, to the social dimension of new media and all points in between, with a primary but not exclusive focus on the intrinsic condition of the object. This may involve libraries. It may involve pencils. It may be done on a solitary or consensually collaborative basis. It will in most cases involve the publication of articles and perhaps less frequently in the age of digital publication, monographs. It may involve, where necessary, the kind of modest financial support from outside agencies that has always sustained the humanities. Or it may make a virtue out of necessity. There is no money for the humanities, and just stick to pencils. All this in itself, I want to suggest, in the present conjuncture, is an act of revolt. There are now only a very limited number of ways to remain an academic in the humanities without engaging in what has been contextualized as revolt. The real meaning of the humanities in revolt is that the humanities now is revolt. Now, for those of you who may regard this as little more than a particularly pious form of quiescence, I want to offer two considerations in response, which will allow us to come to a conclusion. First, I want to suggest that this injunction is the only real guarantor against what Thorstein Veblen characterized over 100 years ago as, quotes, strategic compromise with the elders of the Philistines, a futile doing of evil in the hope that some good may come of it. Second, if we might begin to dispense with the figure of metonymy and move to an adaptive analogy, Frank Donohue concludes his book, The Last Professors, by citing C. Wright Mill's first law of modern sociology, namely, that the individual cannot understand his own experience or gauge his own fate without locating himself within the trends of his epoch and the life chances of all the individuals in his social layer. Donohue continues by glossing that for professors to do this and thus forestall their own extinction, they must first become not only sociologists, but also institutional historians. And this is reasoned, if perhaps slightly overstated, advice. Academics in the humanities, I want to suggest, must obey what I'm going to call the first law of theory. More than simply engaging in a practice that has been contextualized as an act of revolt, academics in the humanities must self-reflexively acknowledge the condition and implications of the act of scholarship as revolt. In so doing, and thus forestalling their own extinction, they must become theorists, that is to say, ideologists of their own practice. Now, it would be possible, I think, to conclude right there were it not for the nagging concern, certainly a nagging concern for me, that a certain ghostly presence of what is to be done, both in my own text and in the debate at large, has somehow not quite been resolved. Not to mention the the purposively unresolved invocation of metonymy. So returning to the text of What is to be Done, I was struck by two things in particular that may provide a more appropriate point of non-conclusion. First, at the level of the general, and this is Lenin from What is to be Done. We should go to all classes in the population, as theoreticians, as propagandists, as agitators, and as organizers. Second, and finally, at the perhaps unexpected level of the particular, this is Lenin again from What is to be Done. But we, in inverted commas, and it remains a mystery as to what the precise purpose of those commas are. We, if we wish to be advanced democrats, must take care to push people who are personally dissatisfied only with their university, to face up to the worthlessness of our political institutions as a whole. I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Esther, for this wonderful talk, I won't do a sort of formal response, and I hope to open to the public, to the audience. I'll just make one little remark about the reintroduction of the term of revolt in a Marxist discourse, thinking back to a certain past, and I'm always being reminded of what my daughter would say when she was nine. She once said, "Daddy, I thought so far you were born in the Middle Ages, but now I know you were born in the 19th century." And I think it's fairly right, even though it's only the 20th century. And I feel that today, when we talk about revolution, we generally mean technological revolution, unless we are historically minded. And I'm thinking back to a time when I was a student, and especially in the French context, there was the debate between, say, Camus and Sartre, and Camus was on the side of revolt, and it was felt to be not Marxist enough, too humanistic, idealistic, or anarchist, whereas a revolutionary like Sartre was hoping he would be, would really consider revolution as the only concept that was useful for a progressive view, a critical view. And I think we all agree that we need to reintroduce or keep the critical edge to the humanities, but perhaps it's by reintroducing this term of revolt. And here my question is more about names that you have partly mentioned, like Lenin, and the question of science, which is, I think, something that is always problematic, since you were criticizing the ideology of science in the modern university. And after all, technology derives as well from a certain ideology of science and its uses and the capitalistic uses of science. But I was also thinking of Mikhail Bakhtin, you know well, who generally introduces a more, I should say, ethical point of view. That would be perhaps a way of going back to that dichotomy, the Sartre-Camus debate, by rephrasing it better as a Lenin-Bakhtin debate. Like adding to Lenin's, I think, belief in science, nevertheless. There was, when I was a student, we all had this little introduction. Lenin's philosophy is powerful because it is true and scientific. This idea of a scientific Marxism And I think that has always remained a sort of stumbling block in Marxist theory, the link between Marxism and science. Never been totally, fully solved. But by combining, perhaps, at least this is my question, or would you say that no, you don't really need Bakhtin to reintroduce the question of revolt, and that Lenin is enough? That would be my question.
Well, I mean, I think I can offer an answer that maybe traverses all of those nodes, covering revolt, Bakhtin, Sartre, Camus. And I want to start with an idea that obviously you're very familiar with, the fundamental bifurcation in the Marxist tradition following not just the revolutions of 1917, but the resolution of the civil war in which those revolutions were defended. And I don't want to sound like an idolater, but also the serious ill health and subsequent death of Lenin. And beyond that point, we have two Leninisms, in fact. Leaving aside the question of Marxism, we have two Leninisms. We have the kind of the officially, I don't want to use a word like fabricated because it's such a tendentious word, but you know what I'm getting at. We have the official Soviet Leninism of dialectical materialism, which allows the key proposition of Engels that nature too is subject to the law of the dialectic, which I think anyone self-identifying as a materialist in the present conjuncture would regard as the most vulgar of all vulgar materialisms. So I think Lenin's ambivalent commitment to materialism produces this trope for official Leninism after the point of bifurcation. I'm much more comfortable, unsurprisingly, as I think anybody who's interested in Lenin is, in talking about the period leading up to 1917 and including 1917 than talking about the period after. And I want to use that as a frame for the other responses that will reference Bakhtin, Sartre, Camus. First of all, Bakhtin, I can't resist repeating this little anecdotal thing because it's almost perfect. As some of you may know, Bakhtin's vogue was driven largely by this idea that here is a proponent of a materialism of a higher order. Here is an ethical humanist kind of philosopher who engages with the philosophical legacy of the 19th century and offers some kind of, I hesitate to say, third way through the culture wars and the theory wars, etc., etc. And the left, clearly, in that particular moment in time, were terribly interested in Bakhtin and were quickly disappointed. And the anecdote that's emblematic of that is Bakhtin's own description of what he did as a young man between February and October 1917, when these great epochal and cataclysmic events were taking place outside. Bakhtin reports that he would go to the library if the heating was turned on. And there are so many points concentrated in that little anecdote. You know, Bakhtin's implicit denial of any framing within that longer narrative of the left, but also this sense in which no one knew what was happening. No one knew what was happening. And for later politically and ideologically committed proponents of a particular philosophy or a particular politics to castigate Bakhtin for his lack of engagement and his lack of commitment is a kind of anachronism of the worst kind. And I would include in that no one really knew what was happening. This was the point I was referring to when I emphasized Jameson's use of tense and this idea that the revolutionary crisis and the coordinates of the conjuncture only reveal themselves truly in the present tense. And the kind of scandalous thing that I want to say, this is the real core of the answer, is that Lenin himself didn't know what was happening. And this, of course, is not the Lenin that has been bequeathed to us by academic history. If you read, you know, Zizek's take on Lenin, I mentioned it very briefly, is problematic in all sorts of ways, and it's perhaps best not to go into the detail of that. But the real insight of Zizek's take on Lenin was when he wanted to anthologize Lenin, as some of you may know, he didn't run through the entire canon and pick out his favorite texts. He concentrated on the period between February and October 1917. And his very sly purpose, I think, was to demonstrate, look, here is Lenin, to use a pejorative phrase, making it up as he goes along. Calling it, inverted commas with a small d, dialectics. Badiou says something very similar in his most recent book, the little book, The Rebirth of History. I can't remember the precise quotation, but he comes very close to saying anything that we view in hindsight as a systematic corpus of knowledge was really just people making it up as they go along. That's the lesson of conjuncture. That's the lesson of dialectics at the level of praxis. So to conclude this rather long answer, I beg your indulgence, the Lenin previous to 1917 would almost certainly have agreed with Camus in the earlier part of the century. Lenin's own self-description was a Russian social democrat, trying to import the tradition of German social democracy into very different conditions in Imperial Russia. Only as Lenin himself propels towards what he cannot know is the fateful date, would he come round to the point of view that you've characterized through the figure of Sartre. So he comes to his own sense of commitment to armed insurrection and revolutionary crisis through the sequence of concrete events.